shocking experience. They were unlike any of the city slicker adults from my mother's side of the family in New Jersey or New York. I had been told they once visited when I was a baby, but any memory of that meeting must have been lost alongside the story my mother likes to tell of baby me pooping in the bathtub and shouting M&Ms. Grandma Anna and Grandpa Jesus were islanders and farmers. Their massive farm in Puerto Rico, over 50 acres of rolling fields, was home to dozens of cows, chickens, roosters, and a 2,000-pound bull that acted like a puppy. Every morning, with the gentle bull walking beside him, Grandpa Jesus would pick grapefruit off one of the dozen colossal grapefruit trees and gather eggs from the chicken coop. Grandma Anna would hand-squeeze juice and whip up omelets, and the seven of us would eat breakfast together like a cheesy sitcom family. I loved every second of it. My grandparents were pretty hardcore. The two-floor farmhouse we all shared was built with Grandpa's very own hands. At 70 years old, he maintained a sprawling farm and preferred to lift cement blocks over his head rather than sit in a rocking chair. Grandma was a stone-cold killer, perfectly exemplified by the day she found out one of her roosters had roamed over to a neighbor's farm. Taking this as the ultimate sign of betrayal, Grandma walked him the half-mile back home, holding on to his feet and completely ignoring his blood-drawing pecks at her hands. "You never betray a Mendez woman," she instructed me in broken English, and proceeded to chop his head off with a machete. I wish she would have also instructed me to look away. We had rooster for dinner that night, and I decided I would stop naming the farm animals. Poor homeboy, never saw it coming. Coincidentally, I would be a vegetarian for the next 13 years, but at least I had learned a snappy catchphrase and a swift solution to disloyalty that would terrify all future boyfriends. Dad promised this move was only temporary, until he could get some money together, but I was in no rush. Life in Puerto Rico was magical. A video rental store in town had a Cruisin' World arcade game, and my grandparents had a seemingly endless supply of quarters. Robbie saved up his quarters to buy Mortal Kombat 3 and Samurai Showdown, and we lost hours in those games, delivering brutal deaths to each other. When I wasn't gaming, I actually enjoyed going to school, mostly because of the dress code. Our new school required us to wear uniforms. For once, it was normal and accepted to wear the same few items of clothing every day. And I look pretty rad in plaid. Each morning, I would secretly climb the farm's trees with Robbie and Erica in tow. When I would inevitably fall into a red ant hill and require about 100 spots of calamine lotion all over my ravaged legs, the secret was out. But that didn't stop me from continuing to play the role of Tarzan every day. Having spent all my years in concrete jungles, I was simply astounded by the majestic, lush trees in actual nature. I couldn't believe anything that wasn't man-made could ever be so tall. In the afternoons, I would scour the pea plants for rotted pods that were bound to be inhabited by beautifully colored caterpillars. I would collect a rainbow's assortment of the sticky bugs and line them up on my dresser, giving each a name and backstory. Cher lives with Dion, and their best friends are Katana and Melina. Son of a bitch, that lizard is eating all of them! It's a massacre! I was learning about the circle of life pretty hard and fast. Every night, I would lie in the cool cement of the front yard and stare up at the sparkling sky. I had read about light pollution in my science textbooks, but it was hard to believe there were millions of stars hidden to us busy city dwellers. Here, in the miles of open fields and farmland, the dark sky glittered with diamonds. Every night, I was joined in my stargazing by three stinky, transient dogs. Bobby, an all-white 20-pound pit bull mix, Petusa, a miniature pincher mix named for a local furniture store, and Leal, a monstrous park dog, park Clydesdale, whose name fittingly meant loyal in Spanish. Grandma had taken the strays a long time ago and converted them to faithful farm dogs. They would wander far from home, exploring the hills of Rincón, but would never travel too far. She would cook bowls of chicken just for the pups and let them sleep inside on cool nights. I wondered if that was how she saw us, another clan of dirty strays she had rescued. It was in this shared dependency and the kindness of a practical stranger that I came to understand the little mutts. We could all use a good bath, and our ribs protruded a little from lack of nutrition, We're all wary of our surroundings, wondering when the rug would be pulled out from under us, forcing us to find a new place to rest our heads. But we were all so appreciative, so content to have the simplest comfort and sanctuary for as long as we could. We were rough around the edges, but that didn't make us worthless. Being a little damaged does not make someone broken. It just means they have better stories to tell and cooler scars. It was here, lying among ants on the dirty slab of concrete, that I found my soulmates. My furry, stinky soulmates. This was true happiness. And that is why it absolutely broke my heart to learn we would be leaving Puerto Rico. After a short time, my parents had grown bored with the monotony, with the comfortable predictability of farm life. Wild horses would rather take the risk of running free than live in the safety of confinement. At the time, I couldn't understand this. I relished boredom. I lived for uneventful days of calm bliss. I did not confuse drama and chaos for passion and adventure. And I had dogs, damn it! Big, beautiful, loyal dogs that seemed to enjoy my company more than any human friend ever did. Leaving Puerto Rico felt like being ripped away from my first real animal friends, my first sense of peace, and my first real home. What were they rushing back for, and more importantly, what would be different for us this time around? Anywhere but here. After 6 months in Puerto Rico, we moved back to New Jersey in the winter, I assume to make the transition as painful as possible. Walking through bustling, crowded streets was a stark contrast to the tranquil isolation I had become accustomed to on the island. But I was determined to make the best of it. We still had our Sega Genesis, and I tried to recreate the bloody magic. Let's see if we can beat Shao Kahn with Sindel this time. I bet she's pissed at him for bringing her back from the dead. I tried to pitch a gaming session to Robbie, but he wasn't having it. We already beat the game 10 times. Let it go. Robbie wasn't taking the return to the city well either. He too had trepidations about our parents adjusting to paying bills again, and he seemed to wistfully pine for the island's adventures. I'm going for a walk, he said as he snuck out of our new empty apartment. Erica and I tagged along. We'd all gone on numerous walks together through the mountainous roads of Rincon, catching bugs and feeding stray dogs along the way. I was sure we could find some sort of similar escapades on the Jersey sidewalks. About 10 minutes into our excursion, we were almost run over. The car, speeding out of McDonald's parking lot, honked at us for getting in its way. While a stream of expletives flew out of Robbie's mouth, Erica noticed a gray cat at the far end of the lot. Do you see that? That poor baby. What is it doing out here all alone? It's so cold out. I was not yet familiar with the concept of resilient stray city cats. To me, this was a Bobby or a Petusa just waiting for a kind stranger to take her in. Let's take her home. We'll hide her under the bed for a couple of days so we can prove Ma's faking when she says she's allergic. This plan seemed foolproof. Robbie finally found something that excited him. We were about to have an awesome new pet friend, and we were about to get a solid burn on our mother. It was a good day. Carrying the chubby cat inside of his jacket, Robbie successfully snuck her past Dad, who was on his way outside for smoke. Now we just had to figure out how to get her into the apartment without Ma noticing. His arms having grown tired from smuggling a wriggling cat inside of his clothes, Robbie placed her down in the building's main vestibule. What do we name her? He asked the group. How do we even know it's a her? I pondered. I didn't see a cat, Dick, Robbie responded. Ew, don't say Dick, I yelled. It's called a penis, Erica helpfully chimed in. Ew, that sounds even worse, I yelled again. The cat began to nervously pace around the tiny enclosed foyer. You need to grow up, Robbie mocked. You're 13, I mocked back. You both need to shut up and name the damn cat. Erica helpfully chimed in again. The cat gently pawed at the glass door. What about Bobby 2? I was a genius. That's the dumbest fucking idea of all time. Robbie was mean. The cat aggressively pawed at the glass door. How about Bobby with an I? That'll make it a girl's name. Erica was on a roll. The cat backed up and then ran full speed at the glass door. Its tiny cat's skull made a loud wallop upon contact. You guys are both so stupid, she's trying to kill herself to get away from you. Robbie had enough. He reached down to pick up Bobby, with a Y, an I, back up into his arms, when she surprisingly turned to face him, springing onto her hind legs. Making a hiss that would frighten a boa constrictor, she exposed her claws. The cat swiped at the air like Baraka performing a combo. Her tiny, scary paws viciously sliced through the air as fast as she could move them. She's trying to kill us! Erica screamed as we all simultaneously flattened against the claustrophobic room's walls. We just wanted to help you, you ungrateful dick! Robbie yelled as she swiped in all of our directions. She was a blender's blades, and we were the food desperately clinging to the sides of the plastic. We were going to be a bitch to clean off. Inching along the wall, he managed to reach the entrance's door handle and push it open. The cat darted out, and presumably would have flipped us off if her little cat paws were capable. I quietly looked around in astonishment. Oh, is that how it's gonna be, New Jersey? I see you. Clearly, our transition back to civilization was going to be rougher than I thought. What we needed was a way to ease that transition. What we needed was a pet. Preferably one who wouldn't kill us. Admittedly, during this time, my dad had his faults. I wasn't sure if being impetuous enough to move us away from his parents and a guaranteed roof over our heads was one of these faults, or if it was a brave, independent choice that should be admired. But what I know for sure is his most admirable quality is his love for animals. I feel like his devotion to all things furry and feathered was somehow passed down in my DNA. While others see pigeons as flying, disease-ridden rats, he's the kind of guy who finds one flying low to the ground, notices it has an injured foot, and takes it home to nurse it back to health. He even converted an eyedropper into a baby bottle to feed it water. When our own parakeets, Rocky and Cindy, were on their way out to that great big birdcage in the sky, he improvised cribs out of shoeboxes so they would have a comfortable place to spend their final days. One apartment we lived in had a fenced-in parking space behind it. When I came home one evening, I found a mini horse wandering inside of it and damn near crapped my pants. Why is there a horse out back, and who shrunk it? I asked, bewildered. He just needs somewhere to stay for a few days, Dad calmly explained, while really explaining nothing at all. Dad's love for animals far exceeded his means to properly take care of them, but his heart was always in the right place. Dad's greatest soft spot is for dogs. Any pup could turn the burly, tough guy into mush. If he saw a stray dog wandering the streets, he would find a way to scrounge up some food scraps for it. Several times, he would open our home to pit bulls who needed to be fostered for a few months. Even though we didn't have much in the way of food or square footage, he found a way to share it with animals in need. On one trip into Manhattan to score some drugs, he found out his dealer was participating in illegal dogfights. The dealer introduced him to a pit bull puppy he was planning on raising and training to participate in the brutal, unconscionable bouts. Appalled and heartbroken, my dad immediately offered the asshole $50 to take the dog home with him. Hungry for cash, he quickly accepted, and a sixth member officially joined the Mendez family. Muggsy Mendez was a chubby little guy with a giant melon head, a black and white tuxedo pattern coat, and a white stripe running down the center of his forehead, nose, and chin. We called it his racing stripe. He was the first puppy I'd ever had, and he was an adorable, chaotic handful. At first, he terrified me. His penchant to nibble at exposed toes would cause us to warily wear sneakers at all times, even immediately after stepping out of the shower. You never knew where or when he would pop up and snack on your feet. He had boundless energy. One afternoon, I brought home a handful of schoolmates to show off my new pup, and he spent a whole 40 minutes chasing all five screaming kids in a circle. But eventually, his undeniable cuteness wore me down. I had missed cuddling with Bobby, Petusa, and Leal, and it was as if little Muggsy could sense that. His first week at home, while I sat cross-legged on the floor doing my homework, he gently crawled into my lap. He curled into a small, cuddly ball and was snoring in 10 seconds flat. I stared at the warm, precious soul making piglet noises, all snuggled up, trusting in the safety of my lap. In an instant, I fell head over heels in love. I thought of the life that was originally laid out in front of him, a life of violence and pain. a life my dad had saved him from ever being forced to live. How could any human with a functioning brain and heart ever think of being so cruel to something with so much trust and unconditional love to give? I stroked Muggsy's velvet smooth fur and silently promised to protect him from pain for the rest of his life. I had heard a song on TV a few hours earlier, and in this moment it popped back into my head. As I caressed the sleeping pup, I sang, "You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away." Muggsy snored in approval. For the next 15 years, this would be our special lullaby. Another quality I truly admire in my father is his ability to treat every human as equal. I always wondered how every person in the neighborhood knew his name and would joyfully greet him as he passed by. Even the homeless, huddled in an abandoned convenience store's entranceway, would wave and shout out, "What's up, Rob?" as we walked the street. He would always tell me to smile and greet them back. They would occasionally loiter around our apartment building, waiting until he came outside to smoke. If he had a spare dollar, they knew he would give it to them. And if not, he would at least always gift them with a lit cigarette. Like most kids who hide a parent's carton of cigs in a microwave, I loathed the fact that my dad smoked. I resented anything that could possibly hurt him and take him away from me. But the fact that he would try and make sure there was at least one extra smoke in the pack in case one of his displaced acquaintances asked for it was possibly the most adorably generous action I've ever seen in my life. Robert Mendez can really have a heart of gold when he wants to. He would talk to a bum on the street in the exact same manner he would talk to the President of the United States. It's just who he is naturally. It's who we all should be. No one is less human than anyone else. It was an invaluable lesson I took with me throughout my life. The president of any corporation I've worked for gets the exact same smile and greeting as the janitor who mops the building's floors. Do me a personal favor and try this in your life. You have no idea how much it'll mean to someone who too often feels invisible. Everyone just wants to feel seen. I know this because my family would eventually be homeless as well. Our worst fear in coming back to the States, that life would return to the chaotic struggle it had always been, came true. Within a year, we were evicted from our apartment yet again. There was a shared coin-operated laundry room that led to the apartment we were being thrown out of. Laying some disassembled cardboard boxes on the roach-filled ground, the five of us and a growing pit bull hid in the back of the room, trying to formulate our next move. We quietly watched as men broke down and removed the bunk beds my mom had proudly purchased after working hours of overtime in a nursing home. These uniformed men spent the afternoon dragging our sparse but beloved belongings out into the street with the rest of the garbage waiting for pickup. Ma strictly enforced a no-crying rule, instructing that it was important to have some pride in these situations. But I couldn't help but break into a sob when I watched the pink bicycle Dad had once rescued from the trash returned unceremoniously to it. I looked over to see if Dad had noticed, and watched his eyes fill up before he blinked the weakness away. I tried to follow suit. We slept hidden in the laundry room that night, piled on top of the broken cardboard slabs. But when we awoke, we found out we had not been as stealthy as we had thought. Covering every wall surrounding the washers and dryers were black streaks of spray paint. Written on the door to our old apartment was the cold message, "Get out, trash." The building's landlord called us out hours later, apparently having been notified by the tagger that vagrants had holed up in the laundry room. Dad stepped outside to talk to him. "Okay, guys," Ma said. "Look really sad when he gets back in here. Take your shoes off. They threw your shoes out, okay?" At least Ma had a game plan. "What's happening?" I asked, confused as to why Ma was pulling my socks off. "Your dad is gonna see if he'll let us stay in the apartment tonight. You guys have to really sell it." "Okay." Erica was exuberant to be given an important assignment. But this felt like the opposite of having pride, and the mixed messages were beginning to make my head spin, though that could have just been the fumes from the spray paint. The landlord walked back in with Dad, skillfully avoiding eye contact, and removed the padlock from the empty apartment door. "Just one night," he warned, "and make sure you stay quiet." We spent the rest of the day throwing our bodies on Muggsy anytime he tried to bark. Though we had to sleep on the floor again, we were relieved to be behind a locked door. It really is the little things. The following morning, we piled into Dad's baby blue Monte Carlo and drove aimlessly around town. When a street seemed less crowded, Dad would pull over, turn the car's engine off, and sit silently. "What's the plan, Robert?" Ma would yell, inciting Dad to shout back even louder, "I'm thinking, Jan!" It seemed we were out of options. Borrowing money from the relatives and never paying it back had made us the black sheep of both the Acevedo and Mendez families. The last time one of my parents' siblings had opened their home to us, they ended up moving out in a burden frustration. No one wanted to be the helpful sucker this time. While they fought, Robbie, Ari, and I would distract ourselves by playing mule kick with Muggsy. The back seat was uncomfortably close quarters, and the now 50-pound pit had to lap hop on the three of us to fit. When he would settle into position, one of us would discreetly tickle the pad of his paw, causing him to instinctively kick his leg back, directly into the stomach of whoever was holding him. Winding your siblings is a solid way to pass the time. At night, we would find a street that seemed safe enough, and Ma and Dad would take turns with us kids, getting some rest. I closed my eyes and tried to force myself to sleep, but every passerby would set my skin on fire. I could feel strangers peer into the car, wondering why five people and a dog were sleeping in a parking spot. I made the mistake of opening my eyes when particularly loud footsteps startled me. I locked eyes with a boy from my class, who was walking past with his mother. He gave me a look, asking, "What's going on?" But I was frozen in embarrassment. His mother pulled him close to her side, shaking her head and breaking his judgmental gaze. That night, I couldn't bring myself to sleep, but I closed my eyes tightly and pretended I was snoozing. In my head, I repeated over and over, "This is not happening. I am not here. I am not here." I decided the hardest part about living in a car was knowing that I was missing the Buffy the Vampire Slayer season finale. This truly was my greatest concern at the time. While we drove around for days, I set my mind to daydream mode. For hours upon hours, I would stare out the car's windows and imagine various scenarios in which I was Buffy, tortured by the memories of killing Angel, spoiler alert, leaving Sunnydale in a Greyhound bus. At night, my fantasies would change. At night, lamps would light up the living rooms of every home we passed. I would stare into those illuminated windows, catching only glimpses of the smiling families sitting on their comfortable couches or surrounding a dining table for dinner. I made a special note of how most people's furniture seemed to actually match, as if it were all bought in a set together, instead of a hodgepodge collection of hand-me-downs and street finds. I imagined myself in each home I stared into. I would eat their dinner. I would watch Buffy on their TV. I would sit in their fancy, coordinated living room, and I would be home. Home was such a foreign concept. I wasn't sure if I was imagining it right. I couldn't put my finger on its exact definition, but I knew it felt warm and safe. It felt steady and dependable. It wasn't the crowded back seat of a Monte Carlo. Home was on the other side of each window, unattainable and out of reach. Home was anywhere but here. One morning, my mom hopped out of the car to use a payphone. She had been reluctant to ask her brother, the last remaining family member who would accept her collect calls, for help. But after some convincing, he decided to let us stay over at his house for a night. Ma was upset he was only offering a short 24 hours access to his home, but I was thrilled to have a change of scenery, no matter how brief. As Dad began the hour and a half journey to our uncle's house in the suburbs, he drove past our old apartment. Our furniture and possessions were still strewn about the sidewalk, a pile of attempt and failure. From around the corner, a young boy pedaled my bike, now crudely painted white. He has my... I cut myself off mid-sentence. Disappointed, I had let myself get attached to something I knew I could never keep. My aunt greeted us at the door of her beautiful two-story home. She was the only white person to marry into our extended family, and for that, she was an enigma to me. Did all white people have delicate, pointy noses? Did they all have houses instead of small apartments? And did all of their houses have stairs? I was convinced stairs were the epitome of success. I made a mental note that if I could one day live in a house with stairs and matching furniture, I would have truly found home. "I'm sorry, we finished all the dinner I made, but I'm sure I have something in here," she said while Robbie, Eric, and I sat around her kitchen table. We hadn't eaten much while staying in the car, and my stomach was aching with hunger pangs. Rummaging through the fridge, she excitedly let us know she did indeed have some Hot Pockets she could share. Fuck yes. Hot Pockets were like a rare and majestic unicorn. They were too expensive for my parents' budget, and on every trip to the supermarket, I would longingly push the cart past the frozen food sections, staring at their flaky, cheesy goodness. She microwaved one for each of us, and I inhaled mine in under 30 seconds. While I licked the crumbs and bits of cheese off my plate, she stared at me in a humiliating mix of shock and disgust. My body was in flames again. I suddenly knew why I had felt it in the car and why the burning fire encircled me once more. I was being pitied. Eyes were looking down upon me like I was a sad, inferior creature, as if my unfortunate circumstances made me less than human. I immediately dropped the plate on the table. My aunt began, avoiding eye contact. "Do you want me to microwave you another one?" It felt disgusting. I was growing weary of being a dirty, pathetic stray. "No, thank you," I said while staring at my shoes. Gosh, I could have eaten 20 more, but the price of being pitied was not worth the reward. I silently promised myself I would never take anything from anyone ever again. I would never be pitied again. My father spent our allotted 24 hours using his brother-in-law's house phone to make some calls to various acquaintances. The good thing about being a mechanic, who would fix a tire at any hour of the night and take in whatever bird, dog, or mini horse someone asked, was that Dad had made a lot of friends who felt indebted to him. The next night was spent at a former client's house a few towns over from the apartment we had just left. Erica, Ma, and I crashed in the bedroom of the client's young daughter, while Robbie, Dad, and Muggsy slept in his garage. The night after that, a man named Don let Dad know he could clear out some space in his home, and we were welcome to stay there for as long as we needed to. My parents were ecstatic. However, that excitement quickly dissipated when we arrived to find out Don and his wife Joanne were hoarders. I'm talking collectors straight out of the series Hoarding Buried Alive. Every inch of their house was filled with items ranging from expensive antique furniture to worthless flea market finds to thousands of trinkets that hadn't had their tags removed to more than a dozen cats and cat shit. God, there was so much cat shit. When traversing through the obstacle course to get to a furniture-packed bathroom, I would step on at least 3 piles of cat shit on the way there. If the miles of useless furniture had been removed, there would have been 5 extra rooms for my family to comfortably stay in. But these hoarders had a serious problem. When Don told my dad he would make some space for us, he meant he would make room for a twin-size mattress, a moth-eaten love seat, and a space heater in his screened-in porch. During the dead of an unforgiving New Jersey winter, my family of 6 practically slept outdoors. The armoires and shelves lining the screen walls of the porch were useful in blocking the frigid wind, but the temperature inside the porch was always painfully low. I looked forward to going to school just to be inside of 4 solid walls, to be able to take my winter jacket off. We would take turns huddling around the space heater while watching a black-and-white TV Don and Joanne had surprised us with one evening. "Check out this great find!" It was slightly comforting to know someone other than my dad brought home dumpster treasures. Though we would all get sick on a weekly basis, we were grateful to technically have a roof over our heads, and we didn't want to mess it up. Ma would limit our trips inside to their first floor bathroom. Since she wanted us to remain as unnoticeable as possible, my sister, my mom, and I had to all take trips to the toilet together so as to avoid multiple disturbances. We were allowed to go once in the morning, once after school, and once before bed. We would shower every other day to limit our use of their hot water, and we never shared their food. I would, however, sneak upstairs with Robbie before Ma came back from work to play Resident Evil with Don and Joanne's son. It was a mind-saving relief to have that video game to disappear into, if only for an hour. They did kindly invite us inside to have Thanksgiving dinner with their family, but I chose to finish my homework, sitting on the twin mattress, watching Friends in black and white, wearing my winter jacket. I would never take food from anyone again, I told myself. After about 5 months awkwardly living in a screened-in porch, my parents had saved up some extra cash. It wasn't enough to put down a security deposit and first month's rent in a new apartment, but we were all stir-crazy popsicles. So they decided to use it to move on. Packing into old Monty again, Ma tried to explain we were headed to a weekly rated extended stay motel.
So we're going to live in a hotel? I had heard worse plans.
No, baby. It's a motel. There's a big difference. She wasn't lying. We moved into a room at the aptly named Hilltop Motel, a sprawling three-building establishment off the Jersey Turnpike, situated on the top of a tall, steep hill. The 300-square-foot room we shared was a serious upgrade from Don and Joanne's porch. For one, there were four solid walls. No longer would a simple thin screen separate us from nature. Almost as important to me was a color TV. A glorious color TV that didn't need bunny-eared antenna to get a proper signal. It had at least 10 different cable channels. I had heard about this magical invention called cable TV, but had assumed it was an old wives' tale, meant to make poor kids feel even shittier. I didn't know what HBO was, but I knew I wanted to be a part of it. Particularly because my mother told me its content was way too graphic and mature for me. Oh, the forbidden fruit. There was also a small fridge, a microwave, and a round dining table for two. Simple conveniences I had almost forgotten existed while camping in the snow. There was a bathroom a mere 10 feet away from the table. I wouldn't have to ration my trips to avoid being a nuisance, or have to navigate a minefield of cat poop to, well, human poop. But perhaps the most comforting of amenities the motel room provided were two whole separate beds. I wouldn't have to sleep curled up on a cushion of a ratty old couch anymore. Dad, Robbie, and Muggsy shared one of the full-sized beds, and Ma, Erica, and I occupied the other. Ma thought Erica and I were too old to share a bed with boys, but I thought it was strange for a husband and wife to not want to sleep next to each other. A typical day at the motel would go something like this. Dad would walk Muggsy around the parking lot and pick up some continental breakfast from the motel lobby. He would wake us up with single-serving boxes of cereal, 8-ounce cartons of milk, individually wrapped honey buns, and bananas. It was a feast fit for kings. After breakfast, I would brew some coffee and prepare for my long trek to school. I had started drinking coffee around age 7 and never looked back, probably because my body was too jittery to do anything but run in panicked circles. It was a habit that grew out of necessity. Having only tap water available for drinking, I desperately wanted to taste something with any kind of flavor and began experimenting with Ma's espresso grounds. I think starting with the hard stuff made me a customer for life. I also like to blame my childhood addiction for stunting my growth, because in height and stature, I still very much have the body of a 7-year-old. The three Mendez kids would then pack up our backpacks with homework and pocket knives and head out for school. Dad had given us all the tiny weapons upon moving in because the motel grounds were a bit sketchy. The seedy motel attracted all sorts of unsavory characters and activity. We were told which rooms to avoid walking past, as was understood by all residents that particular ones were designated buying and selling, which was either a thin veil for drugs or a lesser-known Property Brothers show. Occasionally, while walking to the vending machine at night, Erica and I would get asked, "How much?" by a random drunk. To be fair, the motel was littered with prostitutes roaming for customers. However, I question anyone whose taste leans preteen. Flashing lights and sirens shone through our windows on a weekly basis, but Dad told us as long as we kept the door locked and were aware of our surroundings, we would be fine. But just in case, he wanted us to be packing. To get to school, we would walk down the quarter-mile-long steep hill with our backs leaned back so far you would think we were doing a bit, but really we were just trying to avoid tumbling down the hill face first. The motel parking lot led to a thin sidewalk on the side of the highway. Cars would zoom past so close and so fast I would just about jump out of my skin. After several blocks, our route to the New Jersey Transit bus stop would take us back up the hill for half a mile. After a 40-minute bus ride, we would then walk 10 more blocks to school, and we'd reverse the process on the way back. Naturally, this grueling process began to wear on me. I hated having to lie to my teacher about why I was late to school, but Ma reminded us if anyone knew we were living in a motel, the state would undoubtedly take us away. The goddamn state again. I begged Dad to drive us to school, but he said he couldn't afford to fill up the Monte Carlo's gas tank, and we should look at it as good exercise. I guess he was right, since I do credit these punishing walks for laying the groundwork for the monster quads I have today. For a while, I was unbelievably happy living at the Hilltop. Sure, I would loathe traveling from the interstate into town and back 5 days a week, and I knew those loud bangs in the parking lot at 3 a.m. weren't the firecrackers my dad pretended they were. But there was a sense of consistency, of dependability I relished. We lived in the motel for close to 2 years. It was the longest we had ever stayed in one place. It seemed paying $50 a week was way more achievable for my parents than paying monthly rent. We even had money to have Wendy's for dinner almost every night. Dad and Ma would walk down the highway to the adjacent Wendy's fast food restaurant, and arriving back at the motel, give the secret knock on the heavy metal door to let us know it was safe to open. Opening the door to the dark parking lot and seeing the beacon of light that was Ma and Daddy holding bacon cheeseburgers, fries, and chocolate frosties will forever be ingrained in the sparsely decorated Happy Childhood Memories room of my brain. And though I had lost all my toys after our last eviction, Dad had managed to find an enormous box of used green, yellow, and blue Legos in the motel's dumpster. He proudly handed the box off to me, and I was beside myself. I quickly poured them out onto the dining table and began building. When I finished my castle, I had leftover Legos in the container. I wrote the names of my Barbies in small pieces of notebook paper, cut them out, and taped them to the back of the excess blocks. These blocks would now serve as my dolls, and the action movies, talk shows, and soap operas I had previously created with my Barbies could now continue. I had almost forgotten what it felt like to create worlds, to use my imagination to find a place to escape to. I sunk hours into those blocks. When Dad came home with the Cosmo Girl magazine he found in a client's car, I had even more to work with. This issue of Cosmo Girl had a comic strip of a teen named CG, who would have various adventures in high school. Seeing this brought back comforting memories of my brother's X-Men comics and lit a fire in my belly. I began filling my school notebooks with sketches of my own young female superheroes. Over time, I began actually drawing out panels and creating continuous storylines for my teenage heroines. I would present the stapled together pieces of notebook paper to Erica, and she would always give supportive, positive reviews. I had my first fan! When Dad noticed I had filled up the books intended for math homework, he bought me 3 CVS brand one-subject notebooks, all with green covers, my favorite color. No matter what your circumstance, if you provide kids with creative ammunition, they will blast holes into an oppressive reality and conceive limitless worlds. I was beyond appreciative, and the outlet did wonders to soothe and streamline my mind, which for some reason had begun to grow increasingly erratic. The first time I remember scaring myself was around 5 a.m. on a weekend. I woke up early because I really had to pee. While washing my hands in the sink, I glanced at the red flashing 5:01 on the nightstand clock. I looked at myself in the reflection of the wide mirror before me. In the blink of an eye, it was 5:08. 7 whole minutes had passed, and my hands were still furiously moving under the stream of hot water. I jarringly pulled them out and noticed I had scratched little red lines into my knuckles. Since it was a Saturday, I was excited to hit the proverbial snooze button and go back to sleep for as long as I wanted. But when my head hit the pillow, I just lay there, wondering about my missing 7 minutes. The scrapes on my fingers began to burn. After waking up so early, I assumed I would be yearning for bed when 10 p.m. came around. But as the lights went off and everyone closed their eyes, the fatigue I had felt all day faded away. I was wide awake. Squeezing my eyes did not force me to sleep as I had hoped. Counting the tiles on the ceiling only led to recounting the tiles on the ceiling and recounting them again. My eyes drifted from the ceiling to the peeling wallpaper beneath it. On top of that wallpaper were body-length mirrors. So many mirrors. On every wall. I wondered, why are there so many mirrors?
Was it to give the illusion that the small room was larger? This room is pretty small, smaller than I had thought during the day. Did it somehow get smaller? God, Ma is sleeping so close to me. I have no room to move. There's not enough space on this bed for three people. They're too close. Why are there so many mirrors? Was there someone looking through the other side? Could I get to that side if I went through the mirrors? Were all the reflections they held really just another world I could get to if I tried hard enough? Did other dimension AJ just move? I didn't move. She is real. Why am I not breathing? I can't breathe. Before I knew it, I was wheezing deeply and rapidly waking my mother. I can't breathe, I managed to shout as she nervously looked around. If you can say I can't breathe, you can breathe. Just relax. But I couldn't stop the uncontrollable heaving of my chest. My fingers began to tingle and my heart felt as if it was beating in my ears. Just relax, Ma said as she pulled me in, making me the little spoon. With the same shushing noises normally reserved for a fussy infant, she ran her fingers through my hair. My heart began to return to my chest. My breathing slowed, but I still couldn't fall asleep. I had to stay awake. My eyes had to stay fixated on the AJ in the mirror, just in case she made another move. Hey, Ma, I think I saw something in the mirror, I whispered to the groggy woman, trying to lull me to sleep. Without opening her eyes, she shushed me again. Shh, go to sleep, and stop acting crazy. Chapter 4. Swallow Me Whole. It might be hard to reconcile the fact that I wore denim booty shorts for a living with the fact that I don't have daddy issues. No, when I'm thirsty for a pity party or blaming someone for my adolescent proclivity to fall in love with gay men, I fill up with a deep, dark well of maternal abandonment. I truly believe Janet fought against her demons and tried her best to be an ideal mother. But over time, the facade of strength would crack. The guarantee of a traditional mom would slowly become unreliable. As humans, we are programmed to crave motherly comfort despite ourselves. We want to be enveloped in protective warmth, to have an all-knowing blanket of safety who will stroke our hair and then rock us to sleep, an unconditional shelter from an unforgiving world. No matter how old we are, it is something our hearts will find a way to ache for. No matter how big and strong we grow, there will always be an innate urge to run to mommy when we fear the monsters underneath our bed. But sometimes, the person we depend on for that comfort becomes the thing we fear the most. Sometimes we just draw the short straw of uteruses. My mother has been bipolar for most of her life. Janet was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when I was in college, but she clearly suffered from its painful effects for years before it could be properly identified. The disorder can be indefinable and mysterious, and it is often confused with depression. However, accidentally treating it with antidepressants does nothing but magnify the illness. So, what is bipolar disorder exactly? In precise medical terms, it is a giant prick. An uncontrollable, malevolent force, it is a psychological disorder that causes unexpected, severe shifts in mood and reckless behavior. These cycling episodes of mania and depression affect day-to-day functions, destroy relationships, and can cause suicidal thoughts. Ladies, imagine you are on the worst day of your period, and then multiply it by 7,000. And you're in a sandstorm, naked, with scorpions crawling all over you, and there's a pissed serial killer somewhere in the vicinity, and also you're pretty sure your boyfriend is banging that chick Sheila from his office. Oh, and guys, imagine the exact same thing, except instead of your period, your balls are delicately hovering over a rusty bear trap. And instead of Sheila, you suspect your lady is handing it out to Brad, that handsy personal trainer from her gym. Imagine trying to focus on all that emotion, discomfort, fear, insecurity, and paranoia at the same time. This is the tiniest insight into what a day or even an hour might feel like for someone going through a bipolar depressive cycle. And that's just half of it. Mania isn't a lazy Sunday in sweats either.
Sure, it's all fun and games when the boost in morale inspires you to clean the entire house and start a small business in under an hour. But it's a slippery slope from there to spending $2,000 online, ordering Victoria's Secret lingerie, trying to scrub the shower tiles so hard your fingertips start bleeding, and feeling so invincible you are tempted to run into oncoming traffic. Janet's condition controlled her. Its onset occurring during her 20s, the disorder slowly consumed her, changing every facet of her personality until eventually only remnants of the original woman remained. One of my biggest regrets in life is not noticing she was being eaten alive before it was too late. We were uneducated and naive about mental illness. In fact, depression and anything of the sort in the Mendes household was perceived to be a creation of people who weren't strong enough to handle their own problems. Don't act crazy. That was the stock response I would get if I felt my mind begin to mold in dangerous ways. That was the response I got when I asked if talking to a psychiatrist might help the growing anxiety I felt. That is how Janet and Robert were raised, and it is the sentiment they would pass down to us, even while they fought their own demons. Sadness was weakness. Giving any force besides yourself power over your mind was the ultimate sign of ballsiness. I wish I would have known enough to call bullshit on that way of thinking. Bipolar disorder was not a choice my mother made. Had we opened our minds, had we done our research, had we paid attention, maybe we could have helped her. If mental illness is the greatest villain I've ever faced, then we were all its unwitting accomplices. The signs were there. We were just too busy being hurt to notice. I would experience the fallout of my mother's illness more intensely than anyone else in the family. Always a strict parent, she was an enforcer of her standards for academic success and appropriate behavior. I never minded her concern. I liked having a parent who would make sure I did my homework correctly. I was proud of having a mom who taught me to not squander my value on boys who weren't worth my time, especially while I should be focused on schoolwork and my future. But bipolar disorder tends to take who someone is at their core and multiply that essence by a million. It amplifies and distorts their traits, the good, the bad, the scary, into something unrecognizable. I was my mother's premature baby, riddled with health problems, extremely undersized for my age, and hopeful to a fault. I was the fragile child she worried for the most. Her disorder would manipulate her concern into a fixation. It would transform it into something dark and dirty. One weekend, all of us Mendes kids were home sitting in the kitchen with Ma. As the kids sat around the table playing a game of who can make who cry, I fired off a particularly uninspired diss at Robbie. You're 10. Shouldn't you be taller? As I gangster leaned back in my chair looking smug as shit, my brother shot back. You're 6. Shouldn't you be able to tell time? Ma stopped in her tracks and made her way over to us, laughing. That's not true, is it, AJ? Come on, what time is it right now? Smiling, she extended her arm until her watch was directly in front of my face. I knew how to tell time. I was just occasionally an hour or four off. However, despite my ability to come within a day of the correct time, I was notorious for cracking under the pressure my mother presented. I don't know, I quietly responded, silently wishing someone would help change the subject. Stop playing. Where's the little hand? She seemed to be more or less teasing me. Maybe I was safe. I don't know. Just leave me alone. This kind of back talk was a mistake. She was no longer laughing. I'm not joking around. What is the fucking time? Game time, my brother said, joining in. I always appreciated his inappropriately timed humor. That's it. Go to your brother's room. She snapped. I couldn't tell what was happening. Was I in trouble? Did she want to talk to me in private? Why Robbie's room? Because it was the closest? Looking back, I realized the answer was because it didn't have any windows. Leave her alone, Erica shouted, but it was too late. We were on our way, hand in hand, to the privacy of a dark room. Go stand on the bed, she ordered. I felt like I was on a stage in the middle of a play, but I couldn't remember any of my lines. She tossed the plastic watch my way,
and I didn't catch it because not only could I not tell time, I was also a Butterfingers. I was not shaping up to be the pick of the Mendez litter. Pick it up, look at it, and then tell me what time it is. I don't want to. I'm embarrassed. The nervous tears were well underway. This isn't embarrassing, she insisted. Embarrassing is not knowing how to tell time when you're already in the first grade. I'm so disappointed in you. You're embarrassing me. I was a faucet. You want to know what embarrassing feels like? Take off your shirt, she unexpectedly fired back. Without questioning why, I pulled the t-shirt off. I quickly wrapped my arms across my chest to alleviate some of the exposure. Every time you can't answer me right, you're going to take another thing off. That is the only way you're going to learn. After several unsatisfactory responses, I ended up completely naked, shivering and bawling, standing atop a crude stage, like a stripper during an afternoon shift, but more depressing. At some point, the panic engulfing me began to slip away. I couldn't explain how I was doing it, but I started to feel less in the moment. Like it wasn't me who was stuck frozen in fear. It was like I was watching myself from a safe distance. It helped. Instead of making my mother feel culpable for her method of parenting, I began to excuse it. Whether I was being directed to stand perfectly still facing a wall for 2 hours because of my sassy mouth, or being asked to present my back for overhand slaps for getting 85 on a test, I would apologize like a meek little mouse. Then my mother would be stricken with guilt. She would console me and ask me if I understood why I had to receive the punishments I did. It was a sickening cycle with no end in sight. I'm sorry I was bad. I'm not mad at you for teaching me. I would make myself believe. My mother found one thing more important than insisting I was on the honor roll, and that was making sure I would one day die a respectable virgin. As a teenage mother herself, she feared her daughters would go down a similar road if she didn't instill proper values and morals as early as possible. In an attempt to snuff out any ounce of sexuality before it grew, she hounded us several years before we even needed training bras. While waiting for my sister's elementary school volleyball game to start, I sat next to my mother on the gym's bleachers. I unwrapped a green apple blow pop, an award for my teacher for getting the highest score on a pop quiz. I was unaware of the severe connotations associated with a third grader holding a lollipop in her mouth for over 30 seconds. But my borderline pornographic behavior caused Ma to yank the lollipop stick out of my mouth, almost taking my front teeth along with it. You're giving the wrong impression, she scolded me as she cracked the hard candy shell against my head in front of almost 50 schoolmates and parents. When I attempted to pick the sticky green apple candy bits out of my hair, she snapped again. You leave that alone. Maybe it'll teach you not to act so nasty. At times, I felt I could do nothing right by my mother. I couldn't even walk right. Literally. There was a 6-month span during the fourth grade where she would make sure to walk at least 2 feet behind me to monitor my gait. According to her, I walked like someone who had been having sex. I didn't even know what sex was in the fourth grade. I assumed it was whatever my sister made her undressed Barbie and Ken do, which was aggressively smash their boobs against each other. To be fair, Ma was actually a bit more specific in her accusations. An actual reprimand included, you walk like you've had a dick up your ass, which was immediately followed by, wait until I find out, you're gonna get it. Get what? I wondered. A punishment? A beating? An actual dick up my ass? Was that even a physical possibility? In a world where I could literally walk the wrong way, naturally, I became terrified of my sexuality. The idea of anything I did being misinterpreted as welcoming mischievous thoughts, as asking for it, made me shun anything that exposed my femininity. I became an asexual slob, refusing to comb my hair and exclusively wearing sweatpants and oversized t-shirts. In a way, it was incredibly freeing. I didn't have to be a girl. I didn't have to live by the female codes of conduct or the male standards of beauty. I didn't have to be anything but an amoeba and a windbreaker. In another way, it was suffocating. I feared how I could ever interact with people in the real world. Boys spoke my language. We liked the same things, shared the same interests. I wanted to be friends with the boys in my class, but I was deathly afraid of my mother finding out. Your daughter has a wicked hard punch, man. A boy had punched in class, told my parents after school. His delivery, his shit-eating grin and giggle, led my mother to believe that our scuffle was somehow inappropriate. Perhaps a love spat, or a strange form of flirting. When we got home, Ma gave me a few good overhand smacks on my back before making me stand facing a wall in the kitchen for 3 hours while she interrogated me. Her interrogations always consisted of me having to stand facing a wall while she screamed every curse word in the book until she could get the information she was looking for. Question after question about my sexual experiences. Did I ever kiss a boy? How many boys had I kissed? Did my whole class think I was loose? I couldn't win. I defended myself and yet still got in trouble. At a routine doctor's visit later that year, I was stuck in a lose-lose situation yet again. When asked if I would be comfortable getting a vaginal exam, I met my mother's eyes. If I were comfortable, that would mean I must have experience taking my pants off in front of men. If I refused to let him check me, she would assume I was hiding something. I denied him access, the first of many men, and found out my suspicions were right. Furious at my refusal to be violated at age 10, she let me have it. Do you know that I asked the doctor to check if you were still a virgin? I'm going to assume you're not until we go back there and you prove to me you still have a hymen. Could parents actually ask a pediatrician to check for that sort of thing? I was dumbfounded. I felt violated and deeply terrified of ever returning to a doctor's office. Also, I was certain my hymen had already said goodbye to this cruel world during an ill-advised attempt to change a light bulb while balancing on a wooden bed frame. My body never fully got a grasp on the blooming process, as evidenced by the fact that at age 29, I'm still waiting for my boobs to kick in. At age 13, on the first day of 8th grade, I got my inaugural period. Because my mother believed if she withheld information about the maturing process, it would actually freeze her children in time, I was clueless as to what was happening to my body. I had read about menstrual cycles in health class, but couldn't be sure what was happening to me was the same thing. I knew some amount of some kind of blood would fall out somewhere when my hips were wide enough, but the details were fuzzy. Maybe something had torn in my intestines and I was bleeding out. Perhaps I had been shot in the crotch on the way to school and hadn't noticed. It was a particularly rough part of town filled with very short hoodlums. Our school nurse laughed at my concerns and gave me a Suzuki katana made of cotton to casually sit on and waddle with for the rest of the day. When I got home, I hid from my mom. Television makes this out to be a warm and fuzzy moment, but we were far from a TV family, unless you count the family on Breaking Bad. After an hour of pleading my case, I convinced Erica to share the news of my newfound womanhood with my mother. Naturally, she found the timing incredibly odd. If I started bleeding on my first day of school, that must have meant I met a boy in 8th grade, had sex at some point between history class and lunch, and the blood was actually from tearing my hymen. This was the actual thought process of a real-life human person. I was interrogated for hours until she eventually retired for bed. That night, as my eyes grew heavy, I silently thanked the stars the situation hadn't ended any worse. At 3 a.m., I snapped awake after feeling a presence standing over me. I tried to make sense of the intruder in my bedroom. My sister and I shared a full-sized bed, but she remained unbothered and deeply asleep. As the fog lifted, I realized the figure was my mother. How long had she been there? What was she going to do to me? I looked over at Erica, peacefully asleep, and considered kicking her awake. "Come with me," my mother whispered as she grabbed a hold of my wrist. Her grip was painfully tight as she shuffled me through the kitchen to the railroad apartment's only bathroom. Both our bodies squeezed into the small room, and I stared at her, confused and not fully sure I wasn't dreaming. "Pull your pants down." She left no room to argue, but I tried. "What are you doing? I'm tired. Please let me go back to bed," I pleaded. "You can go back to bed after you pull your pants down." This wasn't my mother speaking. Yes, she was often intimidating and her actions were questionable, but there was something missing in her eyes. Part of me wondered if she was somehow sleepwalking or just tripping balls, but a bigger part of me truly believed she was possessed. She held firmly to my wrist, jerking me closer to her face as she spoke.
If you really have your period, I'll be able to tell by the blood. Pull your pants down, now. In that moment, I could feel myself begin to melt away. It felt as if I was watching AJ as she loosened the drawstring to her Pokemon pajama pants, dropped them along